35, and we are going to have a public hearing on the House Bill 2199, and the House Committee on Trade and Economic Development Committee will come to order. We will have a public hearing at this time. I'd like to invite Mike Selsgiver. And are you going to come all together at this time? And who is that? John Fletcher?
John, just say Jonathan.
Okay, and Mike Swanson?
Well, why don't you just have these two first.
Yeah. Okay.
Second time in a row, I've done that.
Welcome. Glad to see you again.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
And don't be surprised at this time we have Jeff McDonald, and he's going to take some pictures. Possibly, you know, our committee will be in the paper. We'll see. Okay, that's a special guest from the Representative Dallum. Okay, with that, we'll begin.
Mr. Chairman, good morning.
For the record, my name is Mike Selsgiver. I serve as Legislative Affairs Manager for the Oregon Department of Economic and Community Development. As always, I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you this morning to express the department's support for HB 2199, which is a bill that proposes to transfer authority for administration of the state's vertical housing program from OECDD to the Department of Housing and Community Services. With the committee's permission, I would like to provide some brief historical background on the original statute and then explain why the department has proposed this bill. As you may be aware, the original legislation creating the vertical housing program was passed in 2001. Specifically, the program provided a property tax exemption for development projects that include commercial activity on the first floor of a building, but which are constructed with residential units above the commercial area. The intent of the tax credit provided for in this program is to encourage mixed-use development that includes both economic development and housing components in an effort to revitalize downtown areas. The type of development the credit was envisioned to support has been used in recent years, most notably in the Portland metropolitan area in such developments as Orenco Station, in Fairview Village, and most recently also in redevelopments on Hawthorne Boulevard and on Belmont Street in Portland. The authority to administer this program was originally delegated to OECDD because our department has experience in managing tax exemption programs. However, the department in the ensuing years since the passage of the first statute has concluded that it is not the best agency to manage this program
because it deals with commercial development
rather than industrial development. As you may be aware, OECDD is specifically charged with supporting development of industries rather than focusing primarily on commercial or retail businesses. So instead, we believe that the Department of Housing and Community Services is better suited to manage this program given its focus on housing. And for that reason, we approached housing and discussed transferring the vertical housing program to them. That department agreed that their agency is a better fit to administer this program and spent time reviewing it and developing amended statutory language. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my summary of OECDD's views on HB 2199. Mr. Fletcher will provide additional detail for you. So unless you have you or your colleagues have any questions, I would like to turn the microphone over to Mr. Fletcher.
Okay. John?
One question,
yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dallum.
You talked about Fairview Village. I was under the impression this was renovation, but it is for new construction also?
I believe so. Mr. Chairman, Representative Dallum, I believe it is.
It is new construction also.
Right.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Fletcher. I am the legislative liaison for Housing and Community Services. With me, I have one of our program managers, John Wargren, also from Housing and Community Services. I appreciate that introduction we just heard, and we agree with what was said there. We feel that the program moving to Housing and Community Services is a good idea for a few reasons. In addition to what has been mentioned, we have staff that's experienced in monitoring housing requirements. And according to these exemptions that extend 10 years, we want to be sure that these projects continue to qualify for whatever exemptions that they have, that they continue to have the residential portions, or if there's an affordable housing piece, that we monitor that going forward. And because of our experience in doing that on other housing programs, we feel it would not be a very difficult thing for us to manage this program as well. So in that respect, perhaps we are a better fit for administering this exemption than Economic and Community Development Department. So let me speak briefly to some of the other changes in the bill. You see that there's a dash one amendment that looks pretty long. It's about 7 pages. We submitted that change of language to Legislative Council, and it wasn't that we were trying to change the bill so much as we were trying to work with other departments and satisfy their concerns. For example, we met with the Revenue Department, and they had a number of concerns as they administer this with their assessors that they work with in trying to determine the amount of the exemptions. And they wanted some clarifying technical changes made to the bill, which are now included in the Dash 1 amendments. So let me speak to the content of the bill as amended and kind of walk you through some of the provisions that are in the bill. As mentioned, one of the first things the bill does is it transfers the program to our department from Economic and Community Development. I won't go into that since that's been explained, I think, adequately. The second aspect of the bill clarifies some administration aspects of the bill. We met with Community and Economic Development and the Department of Revenue and DLCD. We have also spoken with developers who are planning some mixed-use projects throughout the state. These discussions have led to some of the technical changes in the bill, such as using the term non-residential instead of the term commercial. The formulas are now expressed in terms of equalized floors. That kind of means an average floor. You may have a development that has floors of unequal size, and it's a little bit tricky in trying to determine just how much of an exemption qualifies as a residential part of that building or how much is common space. And after talking through assessors about the possible risks of litigation and questions that might arise, we arrived at this language of equalized floors. And so there's some technical explanation in the statute about how that will be done and how that will be reported back to Department of Revenue and assessors. So we've more clearly established some of the administration of the program going forward. We've appreciated the help of the Department of Revenue and OECDB in working through these issues. There are still some issues that may require further explanation going forward, and our intent would be to convene a work group with developers, city and county representatives, assessors, staff from DLCD, Revenue, and OECDD to clarify the administrative rules once the program is transferred to our department. We hope to have a smooth program that can work well for developers, owners, city planners, housing partners, and tenants. The last part of the bill I'd like to explain is with respect to an additional incentive that we built in for affordable housing development. As we all know, affordable housing is in short supply throughout the state, and the needs are great. We have many low-income people that are struggling as housing prices have really risen over the years. We have, in addition to the regular property tax exemptions that were in place before, we've added sort of an extra sweetener if a developer can include affordable housing on their projects. And the sweetener is that in addition to the exemptions on the building, they would get a partial exemption on the land as well if they include affordable housing. The amount of the partial exemption on the land would be in proportion to how much affordable housing was included in their development. With this, we hope that will, in some small way, be an additional encouragement on these mixed-use developments to include at least part of their projects to have an affordable housing component. Finally, I'd like to mention that this is an optional program for cities, and we have run this amendment. We just got the final draft on Friday. But in concept, we showed the draft to the League of Cities, and their feeling is that, if I can speak for them, I don't want to speak for them, but they're just to give you an idea of their reaction. Since this is voluntary and cities are not required to do this, they're neutral on the bill. They're not in opposition to the changes that we're making. In general, they feel this would be a tool they could or couldn't use as the situation warrants for their communities. And I would suspect, as in some cases, they may not feel that the benefits of this exemption would be right for them at certain times, and maybe there would be other times when they really need an extra boost in certain situations that they would like to invoke the use of this exemption. I appreciate being with you this morning, and we do have a number of other people from cities that are going to speak to the value of the bill. But we feel like we've, before taking on the program, tried to meet with the interested parties about what was working, what wasn't working, and make changes in the bill that will help make it more effective in the future. And although there's still possible ways to make this even better, this is where we are at this point, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Okay, before we ask any questions, among us we have Bob Repine, my good friend of mine. We served together, and I'd like to welcome you here today. Thank you, Bob. And any questions from the panel here? Okay, if not, John, you mentioned you have discussed with the revenue department,
yes,
and
sir.
Also the LCED, yeah. And but have you discussed with the local government, such as the county and city, on this of these changes?
We have had discussions with various staff from the League of Cities. We've talked to a number of other cities, but we haven't talked to the Association of Counties. If you'd like, we could get a letter from them or something.
You're closer to the mic. Sometimes it's very difficult to hear. Yes.
I don't have any statement from them that would give their position. If you'd like, we could have them come to give their position on the bill.
I think we need to hear from them because the local government will be directly involved.
Okay.
And this is a voluntary for them, and without having the input from the cities and counties, I don't believe this is going nowhere. And then a second question I have, since this inception of this bill, it has been 4 years, and never even one project started out of this bill. That's what I heard. Is that true?
We can ask the Economic and Community Development Department to verify, but it's my understanding, Mr. Chair, that we've had one project come forward to take advantage of this exemption, but the project was discontinued. So, in fact, We have not had a project in the past 4 years that has taken advantage of the exemption. Now, part of that is because it took a while for the rules to come into play, that the zones for these vertical housing development projects had to be established. We now have those in 9 communities. And it does take time for projects to become planned and ready for approval. And we do have 3 projects that are seeking and hoping to get the benefit of this exemption, we think, in the next year or so. Some of those people are here today, and they're hoping to see the changes implemented that we've outlined in the bill. But I think that the short answer, Mr. Chair, is yes, that the program has not been utilized to this point.
So did I hear from you correctly right now about 30 projects they are applying for at this time?
We have 3 projects. We
know. Three projects?
3 projects.
Okay. So what do you expect when this bill's changes becomes the law? What kind of a project do you, it will generate? And what kind of revenue impact is going to have to the state?
It's hard to say exactly. It will depend in part upon economic conditions and specific things in the economy going on. But our projections would be that in time this would start to grow and we'd have more and more projects. Perhaps we would have, in addition to the 3 that we know, once this gets going, we may have an additional 5 per year. We're not thinking that this will be sweeping changes that cities will make or that this will have a devastating impact anywhere. But we'll start to see more projects than we have today. The changes that we've made program, for example, they allow a little bit more flexibility in what constitutes the commercial part of a project instead of having it just be the first floor only as far as consideration of that. There may be opportunities where the commercial could be on the second floor or a different configuration, and that would still qualify for this project. This bill makes allowances for that in certain circumstances. And so we're making small changes to the program, not great changes. Yet our developer friends tell us these are important changes and that should enable more projects to come forward.
All right. Okay. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Always try to pronounce your name quickly.
Very careful to hear that. I'm wondering, is there anything close to a sunset provision with this program? I know there's a 10-year sunset for the particular developer, but are we passing this to say this program will simply be ongoing until we end it, or is there anything in the bill that says that the program itself will end?
The program is not sunsetted, but there is a 10-year sunset on each exemption that is granted, as you mentioned.
Very good. Thank you.
That could be a renewal again for another exemption, or that's finalized.
Mr. Chair, you can't just renew the exemption unless there's another significant economic development or renovation made on the project. The goal here is that economic development is enhanced, and if you just try to sign it over to a new owner or somehow do something very minor on your project and get another 10-year exemption, you can't do that under the bill and under our rules. On the other hand, if you had some kind of project that had qualified for a partial exemption and sometime during the 10 years some other major renovation was done, that could be looked at as a separate project and potentially could qualify for additional exemption beyond the initial 10 years.
Okay. Okay. Representative Riley.
This may be a question for staff. Is there a subsequent referral on this bill? Let's go to revenue or any other.
Representative Riley, this is Jim Stambridge, your staff. This does not have a subsequent referral currently, but in talking with the revenue people, they think it would be appropriate for the revenue committee to look at this bill. We are in the process of discussing this with the speaker's office to get clarification from the speaker about the possible subsequent referral.
Thank you.
So, I believe this has some revenue impact, so
yes.
I feel definitely this one to be referred to the revenue committee.
Mm-hmm.
All right. John, Reverend, do you have anything to testify, or are you there to answer any questions?
Thank you for the opportunity to comment, Chairman. I deferred to John Fletcher, who really summarized what comments, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Okay. All right, and if not, yes, Representative Della.
In order to qualify for this, anybody that's contemplating refurbishing an existing building would wait for this legislation, and you think there's three projects that are waiting for us to do something?
Chairman, Representative Della. Some of the people that are here today can talk about their projects that they have coming up. That may answer your question better, but people can qualify today for the exemption under the current vertical housing laws through the Department of Economic and Community Development. The procedures are in place. That law is in effect, and the exemption is a possibility. There are situations, however, under the current rules that may not fit the project that they have in mind, where the first floor is entirely commercial according to the rules, but their project has a little different design, and maybe they can't qualify as they would like to. So there's some projects coming up that are potentially vertical housing projects, depending on what this committee does. And if we have to go back to the current rules or the existing law and we don't make these changes, I'm not sure that we will have those three projects turn out to be vertical housing development projects. So.
Charlene, Representative Dahlem.
Please identify your name.
My name is John Wargren. I manage the housing finance section at Oregon Housing. I've looked at the three projects in general concept. They're primarily new construction that we're seeing. One thing that these changes we're anticipating, look more deeply at the opportunity for an acquisition rehabilitation project. We have a community that has an existing building that needs some economic stimulus to develop that building. We have some existing federal guidelines in our department that define substantial rehabilitation, and those kinds of projects that do that substantial rehabilitation could also be considered more favorably for this kind of partial property tax exemption as well.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So I want to be sure that I understand the history correctly. With the original legislation, there was no application. Now we have fine-tuned so that the legislation more appropriately fits situations that really exist, and we could conceivably rehab three major buildings. Get three projects going.
Representative Dahlem, the three projects that were there, have two speakers in the audience who can relate to that, are new construction. I don't know of any rehabilitation projects currently being proposed.
Thank you. And just a comment, Mr. Chairman. In our community, we did rehab a major downtown building, and it has a dramatic effect on your downtown area, from literally rags to riches.
And do you believe this project, vertical housing in 2199, will be affecting mostly Portland metro area, or thus it could be expanded to any other areas?
Mr. Chair, it can be expanded to those areas currently that would like to have vertical housing exemptions offered in their community. There's no restriction that it's in the Portland area. And we do have some designated zones throughout the state right now that are outside the Portland area as well as Portland.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And please stand by. Yes, Mr. Mayor. Well, I'd like to call the, who's that? Mike Swanson. Welcome, Mike.
Good morning, Chair Lim, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Swanson. I'm the city manager in Milwaukee. And I am testifying today in support of House Bill 2199. sitting in the audience, I guess, I decided to do something a little different from what I had originally planned on doing because I heard a number of questions that committee members had that I thought maybe I could at least begin to answer. I'm not here representing the League of Oregon Cities or cities within the state of Oregon, but I am here representing one city whose hopes I think were expressed by Representative Dallum. I certainly hope that a project can take you from rags to riches because we are in fact beginning a project. It'll be, I think, 2 months after a number of years of work, the North Main project, which is going to be constructed on an old Safeway site that the city purchased under a lease purchase agreement and entered into a contract with a developer to do a mixed commercial residential development. We could not have done that project or have gotten as far as we have gotten without the vertical housing program. Now, I have to admit that when we were negotiating with a developer and he asked me if we would, as a city, support creation of a zone and his application for something called a vertical housing tax abatement, my first reaction was, a what? and after months of searching for tools that we could use to bring this project to fruition, this was the program that actually, I think, did it. The process itself we found to be fairly simple. And I'd say it was a fairly democratic process. We are, as a city, in the front line. We're the ones who, A, made the decision that we would create a zone. And actually, we negotiated with the local governments who had the ability to opt out of our zone. And the developer did not have to deal with any of that process. We did have one district, the North Clackamas Parks District, that wasn't quite certain what it wanted to do, whether it wanted to exercise its option to opt out of the district or whether it wanted to remain part of the district. And so I actually had to go and appear in front of the Board of County Commissioners to argue to them, they're the board for the North Clackamas Parks District, that they as the board should in fact include the North Clackamas Parks District within the zone that we were creating. Fortunately, the commissioners decided to do that, citing the fact that they also thought that it was a tool that was very useful in terms of bringing economic development potential to the city of Milwaukee. Someone asked, I believe it was the chair, asked about the financial implications, and I wasn't going to talk about this. I won't bore you with a lot of numbers, but when I spoke with the Board of County Commissioners, what I did was I gave them a couple of examples of the cost in foregone taxes. Now, remember, I have a piece of property that's owned by the city. It's tax exempt. In order to bring a developer in and in order to entice that developer to make that investment, I calculated that the vertical abatement over a 10-year period the difference in taxes, well, of course, they'd be zero if it remained in our hands, but the difference in taxes, if the developer were able to move ahead without the abatement, would have generated $48,877 in taxes over the 10 years for the district, North Clackamas District. The vertical tax abatement will result in tax revenue over that 10-year period of $22,802, or a difference of about $26,000. What we will end up with is a development with real value that, after that 10 years, is again going to return 100% to the district. In terms of the city, I calculated that our tax revenue on a development that developer would create, if in fact he could. Again, I don't think that we could have enticed him, but for purposes of illustration, $593,751 would have been our total tax revenue over the 10-year period of the abatement. With the abatement, what we would find is total tax revenues of $275,997. So there is indeed a difference in taxes, but again, we end up with a development that will generate approximately, in year 11, or year 12, $60,000 annually in taxes. So I hate to cite numbers without having them in front of you, but I decided to do that at the last minute. Again, simplicity. I did have conversations with all of the districts that could exercise the ability to opt out. It was not our choice. It was their choice whether they opted out. An interesting discussion occurred with the Clackamas County Fire District number one, who have had a bit of a problem with a tax increment finance district and the length of that particular district. Of course, the first thing I heard from them was this isn't just another tax increment finance thing that we're going to have to live with for 20 or more years. No, it's limited in terms of its time. The district chose to remain within the zone. So what we found was we have 100% participation by all of those who could opt out, but they all believe that there was, in fact, a value to be received in the long term from them staying in. And the developer did not have to chase those folks down. We did that. We lobbied in front of the Board of County Commissioners. We got their approval for the Parks District. John, I think, in his testimony, mentioned a couple of things. One is that the cities can themselves determine the areas that are designated. We designated just that parcel because we preferred to retain flexibility for future determinations. I would not discount the possibility that we would in fact do that again, because it has so far proven to be a useful tool for us. I would also, in terms of House Bill 2199, our experience with OECDD has been positive. I mean, we don't have any problems. I would, however, concur with their belief that the Department of Housing and Community Services can best administer the program because of their experience with housing. The inclusion of additional affordable housing incentives is, in fact, I think, also a positive aspect of the legislation in front of you. So I guess with that, so I look at my rather sketchy notes here from listening to everybody. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Again, we found it to be a very useful tool.
Okay, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike, just out of curiosity, can you describe what the project is that you're rebuilding in Milwaukee?
Yeah, it's a mixed-use commercial ground floor residential. We will have affordable housing, townhouses.
I'm not much into design. Unfortunately, I have to leave that to everybody else because I don't have much of an eye. but the numbers of units, I actually, I have an older description that I'd be happy to leave with you, and I'd be happy to update that. I am convinced, and in fact we're negotiating on another piece of property right now because of the movement that we've seen on North Main. I believe that we're going to be shortly after digging the first shovelful ready to begin negotiating on the next project.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Dallin.
Yes, I see some terms in the bill that I would really like to have defined, and perhaps I'm not waiting for the appropriate people to answer, but there are, on page 3, line 25, we talk about an urban center, a light rail system area, or a transit-orientated area. What kind of communities are those?
Well, we hope at sometime in the future that that we might be part of the system within the Portland metro area. Those, I think, right now are areas within the metro boundaries that are high density light rail stations. Ours is in fact a transit oriented development because it will be just a short distance from the proposed light rail line that is being proposed for the city. I don't know if that answers your question.
I'm concerned, does that exclude cities that do not have light rail?
But no, I don't believe so. Please, why don't you come on down and explain to me? Okay.
Mr. Chair, again, John Fletcher with Housing and Community Services, and Representative Lynn, Representative Dowling. The legislation as amended does not exclude those areas. It mentions that there are those areas, and then it provides for other areas as well in the amended version.
Representative Buckley.
Thanks, Chairman. Quick question. John, is it possible you mentioned before that there is a list of already designated zones? Could we be provided with that list, please?
Yes, we can make that available to the committee.
Thank you.
And John, since you are here, when they apply for this vertical zone permit, do they have to apply to the city or to the OECDD or to the housing department? Where do they have to go?
Actually, in our case, the developer discussed with us the creation of a zone, and we made application, I believe it was to OECDD, for creation of the zone. The developer will then have to make application for the actual exemption.
Okay.
But up till now, the work has actually been done by the city.
Okay, since this is moving from the OECDD to the housing department, why do they have to go through the OECDD housing department? They might be able to handle the whole thing.
Right, correct, Mr. Chair. Under the new bill, under the new rules we hope to adopt, the zones will be designated through Housing and Community Services. The project certification will be through Housing and Community Services, and there won't be any requirement to work with Economic and Community Development Department.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Who's the next
person?
Okay. Janet Young from Beaverton.
Hello, Chair Lynn, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Janet Young. I'm the Economic Development Manager for the City of Beaverton. The City of Beaverton supports passage of House Bill 2199. We believe it broadens and clarifies some of the aspects of this legislation. We were strongly supportive of the creation of this bill in the 2001 legislature and have participated in the rulemaking both originally and some recent rule changes that occurred while the project was being managed by OECD. There had been a discussion in the original passage of the bill about whether it should be managed in Housing and Community Services or OECD, and at that point we didn't particularly care, and we continue to think that either of those departments would do a fine job managing the legislation, so we have no problem moving it over to the Housing and Community Services Department. We have a good relationship with them. The proposal in this legislation to create the concept of equalized floors feels like the process of FTEs to me, and it just made a lot of sense. I think it's an easy concept for cities and counties to understand as we are talking to prospective developers who want to do these projects. The process basically remains unchanged in this proposed amendment, and we're very supportive of that because the way the process is right now, where it is a voluntary program that cities and counties can request the creation of a zone, really allows the cities and counties to have a direct impact on how these important projects happen in the middle of our transit-oriented areas. As you may be aware, the city of Beaverton has been struggling to try to create a dense, urban-scale, transit-oriented downtown. And we have found that it is very difficult to create this sort of financial incentive to allow these projects to occur. We were reminded of that last summer when Metro completed a study on regional centers in the metropolitan area, and the city of Beaverton was privileged to be the pilot center study there, and it really demonstrated just how difficult it is to make these projects work. In our case, we are looking for projects that have structured parking and that really create an urban scale to downtowns. And it's just very difficult to make those happen. We believe that the language to allow the land abatement as part of the program was originally intended back when it was passed in 2001. That was not shared during the last rulemaking session when that was clarified not to be part of the program. Putting it back into the program, we think, is valuable. In this case, the proposal is to include it as an incentive for affordable housing. We'd probably prefer that it just be part of the program altogether to allow maximum flexibility, but if it becomes a tool for as an incentive for affordable housing, that's okay too. I concur with Mike Swanson's comment about the simplicity of this program being an attractive feature. It is something that's appreciated, and as rulemaking occurs, if this proposed amendment occurs, we hope that that simplicity remains. And I just thought it would be important to mention that even though the city of Beaverton was originally very supportive of this legislation, and we continue to be very supportive of the legislation, we have not yet applied this vertical housing development zone to any properties in downtown. We will use this in the same way that the city of Milwaukee has used this, which is really on a site-specific basis. So we have spoken to numerous developers, and we would use it, we would enter into a development agreement with a particular developer and to ensure that the project that they were going to be constructing was one that really provided the kind of benefits to transit orientation and the pedestrian orientation that this bill would require. So we have not yet been lucky enough to find that developer that is willing to build that specific project, but that doesn't mean we don't believe that's possible, and we're actively working on trying to have that happen, so we would really support the proposed changes in this amendment. And thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Questions? All right. Thank you very much. Okay, next person is Barry Domingos. Yes. Is Barry Domingos here? Has she left? Okay. Sandy Tucker from Metro, please. Welcome, Randy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. And thank you, members of the committee, for offering me the opportunity to testify today. I'm Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I was out of town all last week and only on the weekend checking. I didn't have access to the Internet or anything, and only on the weekend realized that this hearing was coming up this morning. But I have discussed this earlier in the session when you had the bill scheduled and then took it off for a while. And so I'd like to just offer some general comments. As you may know, Metro has an interest in the development of dense, transit-supportive, walkable, mixed-use centers throughout the Portland metropolitan area. This is a key element of the 2040 growth concept that was adopted by the Metro Council back in the 90s. The development of these centers will help to spur efficient land use within the region, help to prevent unnecessary expansions of the urban growth boundary, stimulate the revitalization of downtowns, as Representative Dallin has already given one example of, and certainly we have examples in the Portland area. Will enable people to take advantage of the investments in transit that the region has made. It'll create economically vibrant and walkable and active neighborhoods, and also when you have neighborhoods that are clustered around transit, it makes it possible for people to afford more housing having to potentially own fewer cars. And that's a phenomenon that actually has been documented around the country, and there are even mortgages that are designed for transit efficient neighborhoods. Are called location efficient mortgages. You may have noticed an article in yesterday's Oregonian, big article on the front of the Metro section about Metro's centers project, and the article talked about some of the successes and some of the challenges that that project faces. Right now, to develop these centers, the market isn't always quite there, and you need to piece together various various incentives to get these places developed. Now, in some places, the market is there. You look at the Pearl District in Portland. You don't need any subsidies to get that to get the kind of development that has happened there. But in other areas of the region, you definitely need to put together whatever instruments you can. And the transactions are often very complex. The people at Metro that work on this are real estate professionals that are on our staff. The article yesterday, I believe, mentioned that the head of our transit urban development program, Phil Whitmore, is an acknowledged master of putting together these kinds of transactions. But any piece that's available to help to push a project from not penciling out to penciling out is something that we support. I want to just let you know about an effort we have going on all this year. It's called the Get Centered Project, and it's basically a non-regulatory effort to bring together financial professionals, development professionals, and government people to basically provide the connections to get these projects up and running. And the opening kickoff of that event had 400 people attending, and we're having more events throughout the course of the year, and I'd be glad to provide you information on those in case you wanted to attend any of those. I walked in this morning and picked up the -1 amendments, and I'm still digesting the changes, but in general, we are supportive of the, we have no, Metro has no position on the shift from OECDB to housing HCS, but it seems like it makes sense. We just wanted to go on record supporting the extension of the incentive to affordable housing projects to land, and you know, to stimulate affordable housing, and also just the general greater flexibility these changes provide. The only question I have, and I'd rather kibitz with people later, is around on page one of the -1s, where it changes the focus from multiple-story buildings to a group of buildings, including at least one multiple-story building. And I'd just like to look more closely at that language to see if it's what it ought to be. I'm not, it may be perfectly fine, but I'm going to just want to have a conversation about that. Other than that, we're supportive of this bill, and maybe even including that, we're supportive of this bill, and I just wanted to get on the record our support.
Okay. Any questions? All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Bob, you have anything to add?
No?
All right. Oh, come on, come on. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr.
Welcome.
Chair.
Yeah.
Dave Barenberg, League Oregon Cities, and I just wanted to respond to the question that Mr. Chair, you graciously asked about where local government, or at least cities and counties, were. I can speak for cities, though no for counties, but first, thank you for asking as your partners. Anything that, as this bill does, that expands the tools that are available for providing an incentive for development is something we find, especially with the caveat that it's voluntary on the part of local governments, is something that we think we can find helpful. It's not going to be a tool that's going to be used by 240 cities, but I think, as you heard, it's a tool that's being seriously considered by a few communities. And I think it just goes to prove the point that in Oregon, that one size doesn't fit all. And as communities are developing and trying to have the character that fits their citizens and communities, having tools like this available really do enhance their ability to develop their downtowns. And as with Mr. Tucker before me, we find our partners in the Housing and Economic Development Departments to be very interested in working with us on these issues, and we're happy to work with either. And with Housing has been a very strong partner in trying to move forward these developments. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and again say thank you for your concern about your local government partners.
Anyone from the City of Portland here?
I don't think so. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I have a question concerning the big picture. And I saw a lot of low-cost housing development going on in the metro area. Mm-hmm. And who can give me the directions, whether it's more needed, or is it good enough at this time, or if it's needed, what's the needs in there, or is this help, and who's going to give that some light on this issue? Anyone in here? Bob is looking at you. Come on over.
So use that piece of gum.
Okay. Welcome, Bob.
Mr. Chairman. Good
morning. I'm Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services.
Yeah.
I think the best way to describe your question, Mr. Chairman, is that in the metropolitan area, without having the numbers off the top of my head, there still is a huge pent-up demand to create more what you would call affordable / workforce housing. It still is very upside down as far as the affordability aspects for citizens in the metropolitan area, many of them, and what's available for them, so they're not paying more than 30% of their gross earnings. The numbers I would tell you as far as the state goes, that we're only able to achieve on the average of about, I'd say, 1,500 to 2,000 units a year that you would deem to be affordable. Those would be units from 60% median income and below. That basically keeps up with the almost the inflationary factor of the population for the state of Oregon, for those who would be in that same income category. Still, I would suggest to you that there's still literally hundreds of thousands of people who are currently residing in Oregon that either are paying more than 30% of their gross earnings for housing, or are living in housing conditions that are substandard to the extent of in garages or sharing rooms with people and or multiple families in a unit to help conserve costs. But we have some statistical information that we can share with you about what are the current demands in Oregon and what do we see in the future. Since I've been on the job for the last 8 years, we have as the population of the state has grown, with all the good work that we have done, we have really not closed the gap, because Oregon is still such a popular place to move to. From all economic statuses and diverse incomes, which means for the same group of people who are moving in, many of them are finding it difficult to find the same affordable housing that Oregonians who had lived here years prior have been struggling with. And so it hasn't changed that much. And so there is a huge demand in the state. I'll give you an example. I was just in Southern Oregon last week, and whether or not this is a fair characterization of what's going on in the marketplace, I don't know, but I was in Grants Pass, where I lived for 30 years, and I was a builder, so I can at least relate from my own personal experience. There was a house that was for sale there, or is for sale there, in an area, a moderate area for homes in the Grants Pass area. It's 2,100 square feet. It's brand new, so it does have some of the nicer amenities to it, but it's on a virtual small lot with very little landscaping and or gardening available to it, so it's not a large acreage by any stretch of the imagination. And that house is selling or listed for $410,000. And in talking to the realtor, he said, that's a good buy. So that means, at least in my estimation, that there are still a lot of houses being built in rural Oregon as well as urban areas of Oregon that are marketing to the upper income people for a variety of reasons. Obviously land costs and infrastructure costs all play a dramatic role in it. But you probably don't see for every high-end house, you probably see you don't see anywhere near the same equivalent number in low-end houses. If you look at them, and we can also furnish this information to you, Mr. Chairman, if you were to look at the median income for just about any community, I would suggest to you that we did one for Ashland. I'll use it as an example. Of course, everybody knows Ashland is a place that very little people can afford to live anymore. But if you took the average income for median family in Ashland area today, it's about, I want to say it's $58,000, which is not a bad income. If you take that income and put it up against buying a house, assuming you had $120,000, based on a 30% gross earnings, you would be able to afford a house just under $190,000. The average house in Ashland last year was selling for $437,000. So you can see that there's a huge disparity between buying power and inventory. So one of the ways that many of the cities, in that same trip I made to Southern Oregon, I met with many of the city managers and city planners from the Phoenix, Talent, Jacksonville, Medford, White City Consortium to say, what can we do to help with affordable housing, both in home ownership and also in supplemental ownership opportunities via apartment buildings. And so one of the topics of their interest was this very issue of the affordable housing tax credit. I have found, like you, Mr. Chairman, and others possibly, when we think vertical housing, we think primarily in the metropolitan area. As I've traveled the state over these 8 years, it amazes me, if we just lift our eyes just a tad higher, we find that most of our rural communities all were designed with at least second floors on them. Very rarely do you find ones that are just first floor occupancy only. And so amongst those, many two-story buildings were at one time either some kinds of rental units or apartments or some kind of secondary use to the streetscape and or the community. Over time, through planning processes, we've changed that. Many times we've actually out and out discouraged or cut away the ability to have residential housing in downtowns. And now what we're having is kind of this deja vu all over again. And we're coming back to realizing that having downtown presence with people is not a bad investment because it keeps those drugstores and businesses open a lot longer than they have historically been of late. And so we have lots of communities, Klamath, I can name some here, Klamath, they've talked about their vertical housing tax credit, City of Redmond, because of some growth spurts they're going to be seeing because of the potential prison coming their way, they're interested in some downtown revitalization.
Sisters, Oregon, which even has some downtown two-story stuff when you look above their Dray Sheep shops, but they have housing there. They're really interested in introducing more housing to their downtown. So you're seeing a trend change. It's a cultural change, I think, also, that where we've always wanted, when we came out west, we all wanted a piece of that little green acre. And now some people are realizing that maybe they can't afford that green acre, and maybe one of the next things they can afford is something back to a more of an urban, rural community center, which many times could include and in involve downtown housing. So I think that there's a pent-up demand for it, some real opportunities to advance for affordable housing, because with these type of programs today, these type of credits become very valuable to when you start penciling out the actual cost of affordable housing. They may not be as important at the end of the day if you're doing market rate housing developments, and that's not to say that they are not as welcome in the downtown area, but when you are trying to get rents down to 30% median income or 40% median income, you need every kind of available tool through either tax credits, any kind of incentives that helps reduce those rents, so at the end of the day the rents are available to people at a fixed rate, as opposed to having higher rates, which then just makes it unaffordable for them also.
Okay. Representative Dallam.
Probably honing in a little bit too tightly, but you talked about inflation rates in housing. And I'm curious, for the last 20 years, the rate of inflation has been greatest in, I'm a social studies teacher, I can't help the multiple choice question. Construction cost, land cost, or government regulation cost? Where is this inflation coming from? Mostly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I guess that's maybe the best way to answer it. I think it's, this is a political answer, so you'll beg my forgiveness, but it really is it's a little bit of all of them.
Which one leads the pack?
I would say that over 20 years period of time, that probably, my recollection has been a materials and labor cost, that it, just the sheer cost of the product, I would say. But I would say running a close second to that would be land costs. And then as more communities have become more sophisticated, why I add the assistant development charge piece to the end is that not everybody in the last 20 years has gotten on with that program. Matter of fact, some communities, just as of recent this year, have just decided that they, you know, have built in or cost, governmental costs through assistant development charges. So that's not to say that those won't keep up pace over time, but I would say in the 20 years, it's been clearly, my experience would tell you, it would be material costs, coming into close second would be land costs, and then third underneath that would be the governmental fees and regulations.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for paying attention to Southern Oregon, coming down and taking a look where we're at with this. Bob, were you involved with the drafting of the amendment at all, the Dash 1 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Buckley, I was not involved directly involved with, I guess I could tell you that I wrote the amendment, but I won't. I was not directly involved. I did review the amendment. I was actually the clever guy who thought about adding the special incentive for affordable housing in there to kind of sweeten the deal on the affordable housing piece. So I guess if you were going to say where my fingerprints are on that, that would be my piece of it.
Can I ask one follow-up, please?
One question.
Perhaps you could give some examples of a non-residential use as opposed to commercial. Could you give me some examples what non-residential is that is not commercial?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Buckley, Mr. Warren has come in, who probably will save me on this one. I don't know if I could. He would have a better sense for it. Maybe once he gives me one, I'll be able to run some off to you. But go ahead, John.
A representative in the committee. the concept that was introduced with the idea of residential and non-residential, the intent there was to sidestep the debate of what is commercial and what is not. When you talk to real estate brokers, they might even include apartments as commercial, depending on how the conversation goes. So we want to make it really clear that non-residential, for the most part, means retail and office, but it's not housing.
in the sense that residential can include condominiums, affordable housing, market rate housing, all an entire range of housing. Non-residential can cover a number of different things. In fact, there's a trend to where there's a lot of retail already and no market for additional retail on the ground floor. We see live-work housing where there maybe is an extra room for an office, but it's really their residence as well. And we've seen that in the Pearl District and in other communities following that line, so that there's what the original thought was, retail would support the housing in terms of the cash flow, and in some communities it's the other way around because there's no market for the retail.
Thank you.
Mr. Jim, Representative Buckley, probably the, again, probably from my perspective, one of the ones that have become more trendy of late, and we're seeing it because it actually is a very interesting business, micro-business approach. It's lofts, office lofts in the downstairs where you'll have a commercial presence, let's say an attorney who just got their bar exam and they want to open up a practice, but they're also kind of having an office downstairs and they're living in a one-bedroom that's up the staircase around them in the same area, so it's kind of a mixed-use opportunity, but it complies with both the commercial aspect on the primary deliverable on the ground floor, but as a residential for them in the evenings.
Great.
And I have one easy question. Where the name come from, vertical? When I heard it for the first time, I wasn't sure what the vertical means. And then why couldn't we use just a mixed use or something easier to understand? Maybe I'm not quite understand the meaning of it.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, that's a great question. Representative Byers, or Senator Byers, was the founding creator of this piece of legislation. I always argue that it should be horizontal housing because you're going to tax it on a horizontal level, but I assume that it is some national credit program that has been established somewhere else. I think that's, at least if I remember when I asked the question of the senator, we have not pioneered this discussion on tax credits, but that there are vertical housing tax credits that are used in other parts of the United States, and I think it's just a copy name of what has been done in other states.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? If not, Bob, thank you very much, and I do appreciate it, John. And if there is any other person like to testify on behalf of this bill, 2199, and hearing none, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Chair.